tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tiny in All That Air, the Philip Larkin Society podcast. My name is Lynn Lockwood and I am the Deputy Chair of the Philip Larkin Society. What a momentous year this is turning out to be. August's podcast, of course, celebrated the centenary of Larkin's birth. And since then, Larkin has been quoted in more times by the media and indeed politicians in the House of Commons in response to the death of Queen Elizabeth II. Larkin's four-line poem, written for the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 1977 at the request of Charles Monteith, appeared to fit the mood of the nation. Of course, the full story of the poem includes a spat with Ted Hughes and Larkin disparaging the poem as a lapidary lark, alluding to its suitability as an inscription and suggesting it was not a serious poem. I think many people have found that poem deeply moving, and I should think for many, this will be the first Larkin poem they've ever read or thought about. This month's podcast was recorded before all of that took place, and unlike all the fiddly business of international time zones and Zoom calls that went into August's episode, this was just myself and Dr. Sam Perry, sitting at his dining room table, surrounded by books and notes and cups of tea. You will even hear the authentic sound of rustling paper. Sam teaches English literature at the University of Hull, where he is a member of the Philip Larkin Centre for Poetry and Creative Writing. He is the author of Chameleon Poet, R.S. Thomas and the Literary Tradition, published by Oxford University Press, and is currently working on a long-term project exploring the representation of children and childhood in modern poetry. Sam takes us through his two fascinating areas of research. Firstly, the intriguing connection between the poetry of Philip Larkin and the art and ideas of the 20th century surrealist movement. We then go on to explore Larkin's relationship with children, both actual and literary, seen through the prism of the wonderful 1911 novel The Secret Garden, written by Frances Hodgson Burnett.
The article, the first article that I did on Larkin in relation to surrealism, that stemmed in a sense from looking at those early influences and thinking that there was more to be said about how they shaped the later work. So that's the article on surrealism and looking at how so those surrealist dimensions of Larkin's work stemmed from his early infatuation with the work of Dylan Thomas, when he was an undergraduate at Oxford. And of course he met Dylan Thomas there, which fueled his desire to become a writer. So in terms of that article, it's that sense that there was a more complex web of influences at work there. And it was evident to me that there were surrealist elements of the work, both in terms of the things that Larkin writes about, but also in terms of certain techniques that were present within the poetry.
Yeah, so because you talked about Sonny Pistatin and Essential Beauty, for example, and the image of the girl on the poster where she sort of blends into the hotel that with palms seem to expand from her thighs. And the same sort of imagery in Central Beauty, I think you were looking at, and Large Cool Store, where there's the sort of putting together of words and phrases like Dylan Thomas does that you wouldn't normally expect. And then that linked it back into the surrealism and Magritte, René Magritte.
Yeah, I suppose it's... The key phrase for the surrealist is that notion of the omnipotence of desire and the way in which desire can alter how we perceive things. It struck me that that's a key concern for Larkin, isn't it?
I think, and
when I mentioned earlier about that sense of the strangeness or the peculiarness of the perspective that he often offers, it seems to me that there's a connection there. because within the wider context, I was interested in the way in which Larkin is still often perceived as the poet of the everyday, and that sense, you know, and in his interviews and his criticisms, he did look to put forward this notion that there was a stable view of reality that he looked to convey. But in terms of the poetry, it doesn't come across like that. The reality that comes across is quite as much more subjective.
No, with Essential Beauty, I've always kind of read it as a poem about sort of post-war economics, really, and materialism. Mm-hmm. But when, in a way, it kind of, that overcomplicates the poem in a way. When you read it as a surrealist poem, brings out quite a lot of other aspects to it. And I think maybe it's one of the reasons why I've enjoyed it so much. You know, maybe in the back of my mind, the kind of surrealism of the poem perhaps appealed to me more than I realised.
Yeah.
And you were saying about the desire being at the heart of this, it does make sense of the unfocused she that comes in at the end, this very kind of mysterious female form that kind of overrides everything.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Shall I just read those?
Yeah, you can read the whole poem if you like, because we've not had that poem before on the podcast.
I feel as though I should point out, of course, that the omnipotence of desire is a phrase derived from André Breton, you know, the founders of the Surrealist movement.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, Essential Beauty. In frames as large as rooms that face all ways and block the ends of streets with giant loaves, screen graves with custard, cover slums with praise of motor oil and cuts of salmon, shine perpetually these sharply pictured groves of how life should be. High above the gutter, a silver knife sinks into golden butter, a glass of milk stands in a meadow, and well-balanced families, in fine midsummer weather, owe their smiles, their cars, even their youth, to that small cube each hand stretches towards. These, and the deep armchairs aligned to cups at bedtime, radiant bars, gas or electric, quarter-profile cats by slippers on warm mats, reflect none of the rained-on streets and squares. They dominate outdoors. Rather, they rise serenely to proclaim pure crust, pure foam, pure coldness to our live imperfect eyes that stare beyond this world, where nothing's made as new or washed quite clean, seeking the home all such inhabit. There, dark-raftered pubs are filled with white-clothed ones from tennis clubs, and the boy puking his heart out in the gents just missed them, as the pensioner paid a halfpenny more for granny grave clothes tea to taste old age. And dying smokers sense, walking towards them through some dappled park as if on water, that unfocused she, no match lit up, nor drag ever brought near, who now stands newly clear, smiling and recognising, and going dark.
Yeah, that image of the glass of milk stands in a meadow, is a kind of very surreal image, isn't it? And the family owing their youth to a cube.
It's the gutter and the butter. They always.
Yeah. I always like the quarter profile cats. I wonder whether there was something about advertising imagery where a quarter profile kind of worked to take people into the picture, and the way cats kind of sit sideways onto you.
Yeah.
Yeah, but to me it links as well with High Windows in terms of that movement from the everyday to the surreal and the strange and the mysterious, and it doesn't quite as do it as an extreme, you know. High Windows takes it to the kind of ultimate level, but this one, it's got the same journey to me. It's going on the same kind of journey as High Windows.
Yeah, there's that yearning for something beyond the everyday as well, isn't there?
Yeah. Although it does take you via the toilets with the boy puking.
It's that, that's it. I mean, that's typical Larkin, I think. I suppose it's really, it's that he has that, I think, a profoundly human sympathy for the way in which we're aspiring or we're yearning after some form of ideal, and then the way in which he looks to undercut that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's one of his characteristic gestures, I think.
And also the language of the everyday, the colloquial language that he uses throughout his poetry, like puking. There wouldn't be many poets, I'm sure, especially in the 1960s, that would have been using that kind of language in this way.
Yeah, that's it. There's a little bit of like a violence to that. And you know, he's not averse to dropping a bit of violence into the poetry at certain points and unexpected places. The other thing, I mean, that struck me when reading the poem there is again the illusory nature of that figure that comes through towards the end. I mean, it taps into that sense of Larkin assuming that the persona of the less deceived. You know, I mean, the way in which, he's inviting us to see through what the illusory world that the advertisements are conjuring up.
Yeah.
You know, and the way in which desire can deceive us in various ways.
Yeah.
But in a way, in a sense, is he also celebrating that? I think there's a sense in which he's intrigued by the way in which we can be drawn in. You know.
Yeah, crust and foam, it's all about emptiness, isn't it? Crust is just a very superficial item. It's crust doesn't nourish you, and foam is just air as well.
Right,
I think every time I look at a Magritte painting now, I shall definitely be thinking about Philip Larkin and men in suits and bowler hats and houses lit up by lampposts and just even... The range of textures in Magritte paintings. When I was a teenager, first starting to read Philip Larkin, and I lived near London, I used to go up to the Tate Britain, as it is now, and they've got the Annunciation in there, which is a Magritte painting. It's a landscape, which used to be on quite prominent display when you went in, and something about it used to terrify the life out of me. It had trees, it had the clouds, but then it had a kind of stone mountain, but then with this white sort of grid pattern on that was completely flat, like the perspective was all wrong, you know, which he does in a lot of his paintings. And again, I think it's that shock of juxtaposition of textures.
Yeah.
It's frightening. And I think there's some of that in Larkin. There's a lot of fear in Larkin.
The dimension of surrealist art, which is noteworthy with respect to Larkin, is that notion of the uncanny, you know, the sense that something that we're familiar with is suddenly revealed to us in a startlingly different way and quite a disquieting, frightening way.
Yeah.
I mean, that notion of the uncanny manifests itself in Larkin's work in various ways, but I think, that like I said, the ghostliness of the figure of Mr. Blaney, like, that's there, you know. I think... And also in terms of this poem, there's that sense where he's inviting us to view something that we see on an everyday basis in a quite radically different way in terms of the advertisements.
Yeah.
And how they work upon us, how they're working upon us unconsciously.
Yeah, like the wardrobe in Obard that becomes quite threatening. And even the postman at the end of Obard. Yeah.
So household objects. The way in which they're rendered uncanny within, the vase in Home Is So Sad, for instance. Yeah, again, it's an example, I think, of how he's often portrayed as the poet of the everyday, but there's often something more uncanny or disquieting taking place within the poem.
Yeah. So that was your first article that you published on Philip Larkin. So it was in 2010.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. So you kind of kept Larkin on the back burner for a few years.
In a way, yeah. I mean, I went on to... I should explain that article was published when I was in the postdoctoral period, like following the publication of my PhD. So
yeah.
I then on to... My focus then was completing a book on Alice Thomas in the literary tradition. That was published by Oxford University Press in 2013. So in many ways, I was immersed in a world of romanticism in terms of, in a literary sense. Mm. And that's a key driver also of the project, the book that I'm writing at the moment, Creatures of Light, the Poetry of Childhood. So it's looking at the romantic inheritance, really.
Mm.
You know, certainly that was a feature of the book on Thomas. Although, like I mentioned earlier, I was looking also at Thomas's interaction with contemporaries like Hughes, Ted Hughes in particular, and also Larkin.
Mm.
So in the current project, that romantic inheritance obviously takes the form of looking at the way in which the romantics conceived childhood, how that's taken on and celebrated in certain ways, but also, you know, critiqued.
Mm.
And there's a driver for me with that was also becoming a parent myself, and the sense in which that kind of connected me to childhood, in terms of like, there's that sense of like, you know, weighing to what extent are these things that poets like Wordsworth and Blake was saying about the nature of childhood perception, to what extent are those things true?
Mm, mm.
And that is something that Larkin was clearly quite interested in.
Mm.
Even though, as we'll see, most notably in I Remember.
Yeah.
That question of truth is something that he, you know, he often addresses in the early work. I think as I get older, I tend to think that's less important. And I think, maybe there's certain poems where he suggests that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is a kind of, in his early work, there is an earnestness there, perhaps, I think, you know, in terms of trying to get at what's true.
Yeah,
that was important to him.
And maybe as his as he increased in confidence and maturity, I think we all start to maybe see the insanity of life. You know, that you can't really solve.
Exactly,
there is no truth. You know, it's all the Toad's world, or Toad's Visited.
Yeah.
We're all part of that world, really.
That's it. I mean, I think that notion of his skepticism regarding absolutes like truth.
Yeah.
Become stronger.
Yeah.
There's that poem which I actually I quote in the Ignorance, which I quote in the Surrealism article there. Strange to know nothing, never to be sure of what is true or right or real, but forced to qualify, or so I feel, or well, it does seem so. Someone must know. And again, that's just an example there of how I think Larkin, you like standing up to that notion that there is, you know, a definite position to be taken on certain things, you know.
And there is a lot of kind of questioning language in his poetry, or, you know, I like that line, I think it's from Wild Oats, you know, useful to get that learnt, that kind of dismissiveness of a judgment or in Docrinsome, when he's thinking about, you know, what is his thoughts about Dockery and life, and he just falls asleep on the train and he kind of undercuts that seriousness.
That's it. There's that desire to kind of work out why things happen, but then it's almost like, as we intimated before, it's that sense of like he comes to recognise in various poems that sometimes there is no rhyme or reason.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, sometimes things just happen.
Yeah.
And and it can't always be rationalised.
Yeah, and it's not the poet's job to answer the big questions of life.
Yes, yeah, that's it. It's more, I think, Larkin was certainly drawn to that sense of, in a way, it's the exploration of his own subjective, imaginative, like world. That's the thing, isn't it? There's an illusion of a commonplace, everyday world that everyone can relate to. But this, you know, it's sharp. It's in tension continually with his own peculiar perspective.
Yeah. Docrinsome. Because when I first join the Philip Larkin Society with Rachel Gartley, the another trustee. One of the things that we've always talked about in terms of Philip Larkin is our essential difference is that I've got two daughters and she doesn't have children and she's never wanted to have children, and she actually puts reading Philip Larkin down to one of the reasons why she made that decision not to have a family. You know, it's really fascinating sort of seeing those two perspectives. You know, Rachel was always concerned about the afternoons life, the women that have their lives pushed to one side by their children, and you know, Larkin talking about just being shocked by someone of his generation having a grown-up son, you know, and wondering about that perspective. Yeah. I do kind of wonder whether Larkin perhaps didn't find children as a kind of muse to him in any particular way, you know, that they just, you know, like someone like Blake or like Dickens, particularly for me as a you know, big fan of Charles Dickens, you know that when he's writing about children, he's writing about himself a lot of the time and the trauma that he suffered as a child, but also that he's using children as a kind of political message, you know, same with Blake, to critique society's values, you know, Victorian structures and sort of cruelty, whereas Philip Larkin doesn't seem to be able to imbue children with those kinds of resonances.
No, it seems not. I mean, I think in the article that I've written recently, I start off there by having a look at the. It seems that his school experiences quickly likely led to him having a jaundiced view of children. In terms of, like you say, he talks about, which says very directly, you know, I didn't much like other children, and I think that sense of him being teased or bullied for being short sighted. He talks about that, and also having the stammer.
Yeah.
That seems to have been formative for him.
Yeah.
Which is quite sad, really. I mean,
yeah.
But that seems to have been the start of it, really, in terms of the way in which he was sceptical about a notion of children having, as well, childhood innocence, I suppose, really. It's to what extent is that, a literary construct? That's what he's one of the things that he's interested in.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And so when he does write about children in his poetry, it is unusual. It's not a common theme across his poetry, and I think it's really good that you've kind of had a look at pulling that together and reflecting on what he's doing when he does, and not just his poetry, obviously his letters and his doodles and you know, there's I'm looking a lot at doodles at the moment because we're putting together the calendar for next year, so we've had a look at a lot of the doodles. We do feel the doodles are a little bit underused in Larkin research. We are waiting for the PhD on the doodles to drop on our doorstep.
It's potentially there to be done. I mean, that's one thing that I talked about here, the playfulness of his character.
Yeah.
That was there. I mean, and that's the irony of him kind of, you know, you've got those letters to Monica where he's chastising his niece for childish behaviour, whereas, you know, obviously in private he did, with certain correspondence, he did delight in that himself.
Yeah.
In terms of the humour.
Yeah.
Again, that's another thing I think that draws people to Larkin, the humour of the work.
And I think the way that he wrote to Amis, for example, that childish delight in just words like bum and making jokes out of people's names.
Yeah.
King's Amis used to do all the kind of silly noises and impersonations, the sort of things they used to enjoy, making up silly poems, etc. Well, to me, that seems like quite a healthy kind of release, you know, of adulthood and responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And a delight in language as well.
Yeah, definitely,
I mean, there's the humour there and comments which might be to certain people's distaste, but I suppose it's all in the mix, isn't it, in terms of what goes into the poetry.
Yeah.
And it just show that that enduringly youthful side of his character.
Yeah.
Which continued, you know, which persisted.
Yeah. And the cartoons are, or doodles are not the he calls it the creature, doesn't he? It looks like a kind of walrus type seal.
Yeah.
But it has quite a rich life, and it takes on a lot of Philip Larkin's own insecurities and concerns. Mm. You know, there's a doodle where there's quite a few doodles where it's on the weighing machine or standing in front of a mirror, or he'll kind of reflect it being a bit fat or a bit thinner, or drinking wine. Or there's in one letter, he is going to the BBC to record, I think it's an Arundel tomb, Mr. Bleeny. And so he draws a picture of the creature sitting at the BBC microphone. And I think, you know, there's a reflection perhaps of his anxiety about that.
Yeah.
And if he can draw the creature doing it, it kind of lightens lightens that. So I think the creature's probably got quite a lot of subconscious meaning for Larkin, or plays quite an important role in his self-image.
It's like a private, it seems it's like a private language. With certain correspondence.
Definitely,
like,
yeah.
With his mother, certainly.
Particularly with his mother, yeah. The creature is a very domesticated side of Larkin as well. The creature's often in the house, posting letters or darning socks or getting into minor scrapes. But yeah, he's a really interesting projection. And I think he's quite an accomplished cartoonist from my, ignorant point of view, but... He puts a lot of life into some very simple lines, which is what an effective cartoon does.
I mean, it's interesting because I think I think Ted Hughes as well was not averse to including illustrations on his letters with correspondence.
Yeah. Okay.
So I mean these people with incredibly powerful visual imaginations and that manifests itself.
Yeah. Yeah, Sylvia Plath was an artist as well, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. Mm-hmm. So, and Alice Thomas was married to an artist. You know, so I think, again, it goes back to that's part of the surrealism perspective there as well. Larkin's interest in visual art was something, it felt to me, that hadn't been discussed. And he did have that. I think amongst his own personal library, there was collections of work by Renoir, for instance, and various other artists as well. I think in the letters to James Sutton, they obviously it was Sutton that he was training
as an artist.
And Larkin was receptive to those influences. That's something that I look to emphasise there.
I thought it was interesting, your article on childhood. You begin your abstract with the reference to racism and xenophobia. Mm-hmm. You know that much has been made about that. As you said, much has been made of that racism and xenophobia that can be found in Philip Larkin's extensive correspondence, but very little about his attitude towards children. And I thought are you finding, when you write about Larkin today, that it's helpful to address that straight away in some way? You know, there's no reference to that in your article on surrealism, and not necessarily needed to be, but I did wonder whether, as an academic studying Larkin, that you feel like you have to address those aspects of him, whether there's a kind of expectation or somebody will bring it up.
Well, I think there is a bit of sense that there is a bit of that in the sense that, well, it's part of the context now within which his work is viewed. It's part of that wider context within which his work is often regarded.
Yeah.
I mean, for me personally, it's not an aspect of. I feel that it's diminishing his work in some ways to focus on those aspects of it.
You know
what I mean, and this sense, it's something that needed to be addressed. And it has been, and they say it now forms part of the wider context in which we understand his work and his person. I'm mentioning it there, I suppose, because it's something where if it seems to me that so much has been, that the focus has been on his letters in recent times, and ultimately this is someone who was known for his poetry, and there's dimensions of the poetry which is still there to be explored, and that's why, you know, that's why Philip Larkin will be ultimately remembered. You know,
yeah.
I don't think he'll be remembered for those comments, the private comments in his correspondence.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's what Andrew Motion says now, that he feels that publishing the correspondence, he knew that the poetry was strong enough to survive that,
yeah,
and to, you know, exist beyond it. And I do feel with Larkin now, it's all out there, and we now have that as part of the context. And, you know, the Philip Larkin Society, we're not here to be defensive about Larkin, but it is, and we do address it, and we do talk about any issue of Larkin that people want to talk about. But yeah, I think I agree with you. It's a shame when it becomes like a main focus for people.
That, yeah, that's it, really, I think. And it's the sense in which the phrase that comes to mind is that cliche of the political football. You know, it's like if there's an article in the mainstream press about Larkin these days, it tends to be, you know, in political terms.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's one good thing that's happened recently this year with the centenary, is that there's a renewed appreciation of him as a poet. That starts to be happening a bit more.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe the papers aren't going to focus on that aspect of him for very
long. No.
Because they have ultimately political agendas, and
they take
prominence over appreciation of art for other, dimensions of art.
And, you know, I think on the podcast, the listeners that I speak to and who write to me respond much more positively to analysis of poetry than discussion of Philip Larkin's, occasional thoughts in letters, or, you know, his friendships even, or relationships. You know, I think most people come to Larkin because they love the poetry, and that's where most people started. It's interesting how you talked about the Anthony Thwaites collected poem and the picture on the front. I talk to lots of people who also say the same, and it's the same for me, that there's something about this edition and its front cover, and mine's completely falling apart now. Something very powerful about that drawing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, there's that sense of the austerity of the persona that's being projected there.
Yeah.
There's that sense of so much going on behind the scenes, and
just a very slight smile.
The wryness of him as a person, obviously, there's an element of that being reflected in the picture, I feel.
Yeah. And I think a sort of vulnerability for me as well, because I think, you know, we know that Larkin was self-conscious about his appearance, as are the vast majority of us, obviously, and to have a very kind of unflinching picture of the face full on, when you could do something, you know, could do anything kind of artistic, but I think there's something quite kind of vulnerable and open about that,
yes,
and engaging, and he's looking right at you.
I think that's certainly something that comes across when you study the childhoods of the great poets. Also, you know, obviously, you know, the insight that you get into the person is, you know, it's an obvious thing to say, it is incredible, because obviously we all are products in many ways of our childhood,
yeah,
and childhood influences, and also the insight you get into the work, the way in which the seemingly innocuous events of childhood become manifest within the creative work.
It's
quite striking.
Yeah.
And you do get, and it brings you closer to an understanding of the person. I think that came across for me certainly in this article, for instance, where you've got the letters with Monica where they discuss the secret garden, you know, Francis Hodgson Burnett's great novel of childhood. And Larkin talks about Well, I think the first thing to say is, in the sense that his response to this book is one of rapture, which you wouldn't really expect, because in many ways it's a romantic piece of work in terms of his celebration of the child's closeness to the natural world. His initial response to the novel is emphatic, in the sense that he calls it astonishingly good, because it was Monica who recommended The Secret Garden to him.
Yeah.
It was a favourite of hers. And he says, I can't imagine how I've never come across it before. And then, he was a fantastic literary critic. And he proceeds to offer some brief analysis. If it has any message, it's surely that, well, I can't put it into a sentence, but it's that life is strong and joyful enough to push up and overturn the strongest and heaviest morbid fancies and fears. It calls on everyone to put aside distrusts and shrinking back and live to the utmost while life is for the having. I do want to get across that my chief impression was a deep one, punched by the expression of delight in natural life. Those are certainly not sentiments that I was surprised when I read that. Just again, because of the romanticism of that sentiment. it's always words worthy. And he goes on to connect the novel to Lawrence and Lady Chatterley.
Mm.
And that's something that previous critics have picked up on, that there are some parallels there in that sense of, the novel is based around, it has that return to nature narrative that is there in Lady Chatterley.
Yeah.
And that's something that Larkin picks up on as well. But in terms of the identification with Larkin's life, it's the way in which he identified with the character of Colin Craven, which, again, is really striking here, isn't it? And the way in which he makes that explicit to Monica. And this, of course, connects with what we were saying about our understanding of Larkin as a person, and that vulnerability of his character. He says to Monica, however much I applaud Mary, temperamentally I remain a Colin. there's a lot to be taken from that, isn't there? I mean, because Colin Craven is this child who is hidden away within the house where Mary is taken to stay following the death of her parents, and Colin believes himself to be, almost terminally ill. And both of their lives, Mary and Colin, are resurrected through contact with the garden.
Yeah.
I mean, that this is another thing why it's a piece of work which perhaps we wouldn't associate with Larkin, because there is that the spiritual, straight religious dimension of the work is very, very strong. But he's responding to it here.
Because the children learn how to pray, don't they, in the garden?
I mean, I think really I'd see that more in the sense of the way in which the novel is celebrating the instinctive spirituality of the child.
I think
it's something that is like within them, that is latent, but the garden brings out.
Because they're both very neglected in terms of their emotional development, aren't they?
That's it. The children have not really been loved. I mean, I don't know. I mean, is that another reason why Larkin identified very strongly with them? That is one of his themes. One of his themes is the absence of love. He's one of the great love poets for that reason.
Yeah.
I remember speaking to someone once, and they said, Larkin, he told it how it is, kind of thing. That seems relevant to me in terms of his status as a love poet. It's the extent of that identification with Colin is very striking, and there's various aspects of it, because there's this distant relationship with the father, as you say, who does love him, and obviously that kind of is brought there is a happy ending.
I
just think it kind of points to dimensions of Larkin's character, which were repressed in certain ways, and there is a sense in which, in certain poems, and certainly perhaps here, you get a sense that there's that. One of the reasons why he was intrigued by the literature of childhood is because there's that sense in him, like, would his own life have taken different directions if his childhood had been different? That's something that it seems to me that he was interested in.
And I think Colin Craven, I think, to me, is quite symbolic of a kind of potential side of us all, you know, the selfish, lonely child that perhaps is refusing to engage with the outside world to some extent as well, you know, the awkward side of ourselves, the petulant, the hypochondriac, that we can all have a tendency towards, you know, because Colin has to make that step for himself as much as anything. He has to decide that he wants to leave the bedroom and engage with Mary and get himself outside. He has to go on that journey.
He does, yeah. I mean, they kind of end up having to drag him out. It's kind of like, it's almost like there is that potential within him, like you say, but it's like he needs them to rescue him and to get him out there.
And again, there's a lot of humour in the book, you know, and I think like Mary's reaction to Colin is funny, in the way that Mary's the only person that can actually speak the truth to him and argue with him.
Yeah, she's direct with him.
So it's a fascinating book to read, actually, and I think one that has rightly stayed very popular book, you know. And I know you were saying you'd seen the film that was made about a couple of years ago, came out.
It was, yeah. Colin Firth was the father, and I mean, it was wonderfully effective, like on the big screen, in terms of the visual dimension.
Yeah, of the garden
coming to life. Yeah. Something that's been dormant, and I mean, I suppose the movement of the seasons and the way in which that reflects the rebirth of those characters is very moving.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think with Larkin, there's that sense of, like, even here he's almost kind of saying, you know, however much I applaud Mary, I remain a Colin. So there's that there's that sense of which he knew that he would, he can't quite, he's attracted to that romantic narrative, but he can't quite fully embrace it.
No.
It's like, you know, ultimately he's kind of saying, I might like to be like that, but that's not who I am. Like,
yeah. Really,
you know?
Yeah.
And of course, in the later work, there is that sense of, Larkin not being able, perhaps, to escape those feelings of morbidity that he's looking to transcend here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, if you think of a poem like "Obeyed," for instance, in the context of the following passage from The Secret Garden, it seems to me quite revealing. This is from towards the end of the novel. So long as Colin shut himself up in his room and thought only of his fears and weakness and his detestation of people who looked at him and reflected hourly on humps and early death, he was a hysterical, half-crazy little hypochondriac who knew nothing of sunshine in the spring and also did not know that he could get well and stand upon his feet if he tried to do it. When new beautiful thoughts began to push out the old hideous ones, life began to come back to him. His blood ran healthily through his veins and strength poured into him like a flood.
Yeah, that's really astonishing passage, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
And, that impulse is something that obviously, you know, that resonated with Larkin as well. I mean, it's intriguing to think whether, like, if Larkin's life had taken a different path, would this aspect of him, this kind of suppressed romanticism, would it have led in different directions? Would it have led to a different kind of work?
Mm, mm.
If he hadn't embraced in a way, the Hardy perspective or the Hardy view of life? Or was he that just, or was that in a way who he was? I don't know.
But the physical infirmity that Larkin suffered throughout his life,
yes, yeah,
puts him into the kind of Colin experience.
That's part of it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly.
Because one of the things about Dickon in Secret Garden is he's full of energy, isn't he, and health, even though we know he lives, you know, very, 12 children in a cottage,
yeah,
and they're living basically on bread and milk, and, you know, he still has this, like, magical levels of energy that he seems to get directly from the sun, you know.
Yeah, directly from his interaction with natural world, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He's a Laurentian figure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean. The contrast with the tension between Larkin and Hughes is relevant. I mean, I think you were talking earlier about Larkin's sensitivity regarding his appearance, and of course you have got some of those photos where you've got Larkin when Hughes came to give a reading at Hull, and you've got Larkin stood alongside Hughes, and it's almost like Hughes is there almost looking like a rock star, and Larkin is looking like an accountant. And there's letters written from Larkin afterwards where he's remarking on that, you know, he's struck by that contrast. It's like, is that really the way in which I'm perceived? Is that really me? But again, I think it makes me warm to him, really, I suppose, in the way, the way he had that vulnerability. And,
definitely. And you know, Hughes's appearance, I would imagine, is the same sort of shield, you know, that persona of himself as the hunting man and the you know, the strong man.
Yeah, it's like a Dickon figure, really.
Yeah.
And I think Hughes is, I mean, that certainly, well, I know that, you know, elements of Hughes's childhood were like that. He was someone who was immersed in the life of the seasons, and obviously his fascination with animal life came from his interaction with landscape. And again, there's contrast with Larkin. He's the bookish child, isn't he, really?
Yeah, because that was the household environment with lots of books and lots of really good quality, challenging reading. And he was really encouraged with that. But, you know, they didn't go out for romps in the countryside.
No, that's it. There's not that much of that that first-hand interaction with nature.
No.
And yet, of course, you know, I mean, in terms of Larkin's ability to evoke natural phenomena is remarkable.
You know,
at times, in terms of his ability to scope, to evoke certain dimensions of the English landscape. You know, as that essay by Heaney, like England of the Mind, and then the way in which he compares Heaney, Hughes and Hill and different versions of England that they project. It's a very illuminating piece of writing. Again, is a sense in which it goes back to the different childhoods, perhaps, that they had. You know, their different versions of England, the different views of the landscape were grounded in that. And that sense of Larkin is, you know, he's partly a poet of suburbia, isn't he, as well?
That's it. Yeah,
because that was the environment in which he grew up. And again, I think that's another reason, I think, for his popularity. You know, because it's the environment in which so many people have grown up.
Yeah, it's the world we live in, isn't it?
And increasingly so.
Yeah. Department stores and advertising hoardings and railways and pubs and bars. And in your article, you make that link from The Secret Garden into I Remember, where you suggest one of the stanzas is actually a kind of reference to Secret Garden.
Oh, yeah, I do suggest that. Yeah, that's I've forgotten that.
Yeah.
thank you for reminding me. But, yeah, I think that's the case.
Because it was only written not 6 months after.
Exactly, not least because of the proximity in which he read that poem. Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that I think it's the fourth stanza here. That there are references to the Secret Garden, as well as the garden in Thomas Hood's poem, Of Course I Remember, I Remember, which is also alluded to in the title. Shall I read this one?
Yeah.
Okay. I remember. Coming up England by a different line for once, early in the cold new year, we stopped. And watching men with number plates sprint down the platform to familiar gates, why Coventry, I exclaimed, I was born here. I leant far out and squinted for a sign that this was still the town that had been mine so long, but found I wasn't even clear which side was which. From where those cycle crates were standing, had we annually departed for those family halls? A whistle went. Things moved. I sat back, staring at my boots. Was that, my friend smiled, where you have your roots? No, only where my childhood was unspent, I wanted to retort, just where I started. By now, I've got the whole place clearly charted. Our garden first, where I did not invent blinding theologies of flowers and fruits, and wasn't spoken to by an old hat. And here we have that splendid family I never ran to when I got depressed. The boys all biceps and the girls all chest. Their comic Ford, their farm, where I could be really myself. I'll show you, come to that. The bracken, where I never trembling sat, determined to go through with it. Where she lay back and all became a burning mist. And in those offices, my doggerel was not set up in blunt 10-point, nor read by a distinguished cousin of the mayor, who didn't call and tell my father, there before us had we the gift to see ahead. You look as if you wished the place in hell, my friend said, judging from your face. Oh well, I suppose it's not the place's fault, I said. Nothing, like something, happens anywhere. So, I mean, again, one shouldn't generalise too much, but I feel, again, this is one of those poems where, again, Larkin is pushing back against the romantic notion of childhood as it were, the best time of your life.
Yeah.
And again, I feel that that's something that a lot of people will be able to relate to. And
And he says, you know, it's not the place's fault. It's not, you know, I think sometimes people characterise Larkin as kind of disparaging Coventry, but I don't really get a sense of that here. I think it's more that the narrator doesn't have a lot to say about his childhood, sort of emptiness to it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think in some ways the narrator's putting on a front because of the things most have happened. But yeah, I don't feel he's disparaging the place. I think he's just saying that this just happens to have been the place.
It was
the things that, in a way, the things that he's read about who he might want to have happened that didn't happen.
But yeah,
he's making the point that will be the case for most people.
Yeah.
I think in terms of these references to the secret garden. You've got that notion of the garden where I did not invent blinding theologies of flowers and fruits. This seems to me a reference to the way in which Colin, following his own personal transformation at the hands of the garden and his interaction with working outside, he goes on to say that he's going to write a book about magic based on what's happened to him.
Yeah.
So that's this sense of, you know, a personal theology of flowers and fruits. You know. And the old hats, you know, it seems that can be read as an allusion to the gardener Ben Weatherstaff in the Secret Garden, who directs Mary towards its location and the key by which she gains entry to it. So, given that, you know, it was only a matter of months after he wrote that letter to Monica, it seems highly likely that that book was still in his mind, still at work within his imagination.
So when is your When is your book coming out then?
The book on childhood. That should be out within the next couple of years. I've written chapters on Yeats, Edward Thomas, R.S. Thomas, and Hughes. So yeah, I've got a couple to go. But in some ways, the Larkin article is another step on the road, and an important one. As I say, it's a counterpoint in some ways to that romantic narrative, which is at the heart of that book.
Yeah,
and a necessary one to a certain extent. So in terms of the book, I think what comes across strongly there as well, I suppose, is the way in which people like Hughes and Heaney and also Edward Thomas and Yeats had an interest in the education of children. And that, it seems to me, perhaps that does come from having children themselves, and maybe that's something, the reason why Larkin, he didn't have that same interest, you know.
I think you can become very distant. I mean, my children now are 16 and 24 left home, and you start to leave behind the kind of rhythms of the school year, and you know, the children's clothes and the children's toys and all those kind of trappings sort of slowly recede, and it does, you start to remember what it's like to not have children in your life, and to be a little bit, you can get a little bit impatient with children again and feel like, you know,
to be outside of that. And that's the perspective that Larkin often writes from, I think, you know, in terms of like, so afternoons, that Pony mentioned earlier, and I think Toto Revisited, when he's in the park and talks about the children, seeing the children going home after school. You get a strong sense of them standing outside.
Yeah, you do. And obviously Monica as well would have been very much outside. And so children weren't part of his daily life. And so you are going to get an outsider's perspective. Of course, when you speak to people that whose children interacted with Larkin, like Eddie Dawes, they tell you that he was really good with the children at Anne Thwaite. You know, he was very gentle with them. He'd, you know, show interest in them and talk to them and, you know, quite enjoy their company, really.
That's it. And there's that anecdote from Amos where he talks about when he met Larkin in the company of Rosemary, his niece, and Rosemary seemed very fond of Larkin, which was a surprise given that Larkin had, you know, habitually slagged her off in his correspondence. So that's it. I mean, you know, as always with Larkin, to what extent was it a persona that he was projecting? To what extent, you know, was that meeting a real reflection of the relationship?
It's
hard to say.
And when we were planning this, when I was reading your article, you drew my attention to this book, Peter Coveney, The Image of Childhood.
Yes.
And this was a Larkin, an aspect of Larkin's life or work that I wasn't familiar with before.
Yeah, this book came to my attention because, I mean, I was aware of it before I began work on the article, but it's mentioned by Larkin in a review of the collected poems of Emily Dickinson and Walter Delamere that he published in The Observer in 1970. And that review is one of those pieces which were... It's one of Larkin's most overt criticism of the literary cult of childhood. There's a persona at work here, but there's a lot of venom in what he says about, you know, he talks about the illusions of the romantic movement, you know, and in a way, you know, he says that it's that any writer of genuine stature would not adopt the matter of childhood or the persona of the child as, you know, their principal mode. So it's a notable piece on that basis, and it's that side of Larkin, as you know, his criticisms of children became seemed to have become more overt as he grew older. And of course we see that also in the poems in High Windows, including the notorious, you know, This Be the Verse. However, at the same time, it's also a review that reflects his fascination with the subject of childhood as well. And one sign of this is that he talks about, he mentions this book by Peter Coveney, in which Coveney looks at, you know, this is a serious, lengthy study, a work of literary criticism, in which he looks at, he traces the way in which childhood has been presented from the Romantics up until the middle of the 20th century. The first edition of the book was published in 1957. Coveney's primary interest is the way in which childhood has been represented in fiction, in the work of the Victorian novelists and also modernists like Lawrence and Woolf. Boy, there are chapters, some of the early chapters do look at the Romantic poets and Wordsworth and Blake. And Larkin had played a role in the writing of this book, it turns out, because Coveney was a lecturer within the history department at the University of Hull. And so the two men obviously knew each other. And this came to light when I found a dedication within the preface to the first edition by Coveney, where he says, "I should like to thank the librarian of the University of Hull, Mr. Philip Larkin, and his staff, for their great assistance and long suffering in obtaining for me the works I needed."
Mm.
And it just seems to me that given the fact that Larkin mentions the book approvingly in his review of Dickinson and Delamere, and given that Coveney returns the compliments in the preface, it seemed highly likely that the two men must have discussed this book, you know, at some point.
Yeah.
You know, given that they were working in the same institution.
Yeah.
And of course, given Larkin's own tremendous knowledge of the English tradition.
Yeah.
Like I say, in terms of Larkin's one of Larkin's great strengths as a writer, and which is underplayed, I think, certainly at the moment, is the perceptiveness of his literary criticism.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, this is something that I was unaware of, and again, well, this is one example of the things that come up through the research process. You know, that Larkin had played a role ultimately in a way in bringing this book into being, and it's reflective of the fact that even though he, in this review, there's that sense of him being repelled by the literature of childhood and the degree to which romantic ideas of childhood have been celebrated, he's also fascinated by it, and he'd taken the time to read this book.
Yeah,
I mean, he says that anyone wanting to know the full story of the way the child has been represented in modern literature should consult Peter Coveney's Absorbing the Image of Childhood, which moves from Blake to J.D. Salinger with dispassionate penetration and humour. Now, I mean, one thing to note there, of course, I think, is that dispassionate penetration and humour, they're attributes of Larkin's own writing.
Yeah,
I mean, there is a sense in which he's playing to his audience and his own agenda here.
And also his professionalism and generosity as a librarian. And you do hear accounts about, you know, how helpful he was to people and approachable and supportive, you know. And when people sent him books to review or asked him, you know, for career advice, he was always very honest, wasn't he? And you know, didn't always give people the answers that they actually were looking for, but he always seemed to be supportive and helpful.
Yeah, absolutely, and certainly in the case of works which he saw value in.
I think
this is the thing, is like that's the irony of the review, the irony of his criticism of the literature of childhood, is that he could clearly see the value in Coveney's projects, and he must have worked on this book for years. And one of the reasons for that is that Larkin would have understood that childhood, the way in which that's been represented, is one of the key facets of the literary tradition.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And that was something that did matter to him, I think.
No, it's a really fascinating way to sort of pull it all together. And I've actually enjoyed reading some of the Peter Coveney. I found it quite interesting. I don't think I've found the humour in it.
I think it's of its time.
Yes, it is.
And some of it is quite dry.
Yeah.
I think the other thing to mention is that there's a letter to Monica in which Larkin talks about having enjoyed reading Salinger, enjoyed reading Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
So again, there's further evidence of that interest in the literature of childhood and of youth.
Thank you so much to Sam for this really thought-provoking discussion, and I'm looking forward to reading his book when it's completed. The Philip Larkin Centre at the University of Hull has recently launched the Larkin Prize, which is a fantastic new competition open to all young people aged between 16 and 30 on the closing date of 31st of October 2022. They are inviting young people to enter poems written on the theme of the everyday now. The prize is a fantastic £300, but also winning it would be such an achievement. They are hoping for really diverse and imaginative entries. If you are or know someone who might want to take part, then look for the Larkin Prize on the University of Hull website. Who knows, you may even get the winner on the podcast. I hope everyone has been enjoying this year's centenary events. And if you haven't seen Dr. Philip Pullen in action, then you still have time to attend his talks as he traverses the country. He's already been to Hull, Wellington, Coventry, the Channel Islands and beyond. Please have a look at our website for the details about upcoming events. It's been an amazing year so far, and we have increased our membership significantly. It's lovely to have so many more people be part of all that we do at the Society. This podcast was produced by Simon Galloway, and the opening music is The Horns of the Morning by The Mechanicals Band. And as ever, if you have any comments or any suggestions, I love hearing from you, so please get in touch.
The horns of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the coldest of June.